Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Yiddish Policeman's Union by Michael Shabom, narrated by Peter Riegert. This book is copyrighted 2007 by Michael Shabom, and there will be an interview with the author at the end of this program. For 60 years, Jewish refugees and their descendants have prospered in the Federal District of Sitka, a temporary safe haven created in the wake of the Holocaust and the shocking 1948 collapse of the fledgling State of Israel. The Jews of Sitka District have created their own little world in the Alaskan Panhandle, a vibrant and complex frontier city that moves to the music of Yiddish. But now the district is set to revert to Alaskan control, and their dream is coming to an end. And now, The Yiddish Policeman's Union.
One. 9 months, Lantzman's been flopping at the Hotel Zamenhof without any of his fellow residents managing to get themselves murdered. Now somebody has put a bullet in the brain of the occupant of 208, a Yid who was calling himself Emmanuel Lasker. "He didn't answer the phone, he wouldn't open his door," says Tenenbaum, the night manager, when he comes to roust Lantzman. Lantzman lives in 505, with a view of the neon sign on the hotel across Max Nordau Street. That one is called the Blackpool, a word that figures in Lantzman's nightmares. I had to let myself in, it was Rome. The night manager is a former U.S. Marine who kicked a heroin habit of his own back in the 60s after coming home from the shambles of the Cuban War. He takes a motherly interest in the user population of the Zamenhof. He extends credit to them and sees that they are left alone when that is what they need. "Did you touch anything in the room?" Lantzman says. Tenenbaum says, "Only the cash and jewelry." Lantzman puts on his trousers and shoes and hitches up his suspenders. Then he and Tenenbaum turn to look at the doorknob where a necktie hangs, red with a fat maroon stripe already knotted to save time. Lantzman has 8 hours to go until his next shift. 8 rat hours, sucking at his bottle in his glass tank lined with wood shavings. Lantzman sighs and goes for the tie. He slides it over his head and pushes up the knot to his collar. He puts on his jacket, feels for the wallet and shield in the breast pocket, pats the sholem he wears in a holster under his arm, a chopped Smith & Wesson Model 39. "I hate to wake you, detective," Tenenbaum says, "only I notice that you don't really sleep." "I sleep," Lantzman says. He picks up the shot glass that he is currently dating, a souvenir of the World's Fair of 1977. "It's just I do it in my underpants and shirt." He lifts the glass and toasts to 30 years gone since the Sitka World's Fair, a pinnacle of Jewish civilization in the North, people say, and who is he to argue? Meyer Lantzman was 14 that summer, and just discovering the glories of Jewish women, for whom 1977 must have been some kind of a pinnacle. Sitting up in a chair, he drains the glass, wearing a shalom. According to doctors, therapists, and his ex-wife, Lantzman drinks to medicate himself, turning the tubes and crystals of his moods with a crude hammer of 100-proof plum brandy. But the truth is that Lantzman has only 2 moods, working and dead. Meyer Lantzman is the most decorated shamus in the district of Sitka, the man who solved the murder of the beautiful Froma Lefkowitz by her furrier husband, and caught Podolsky, the hospital killer. His testimony sent Hyman Sharney to federal prison for life, the first and last time that criminal charges against a Verbover wise guy have ever been made to stick. He has the memory of a convict, the balls of a fireman, and the eyesight of a housebreaker. When there is crime to fight, Lantzman tears around Sitka like a man with his pant leg caught on a rocket. It's like there's a film score playing behind him, heavy on the castanets. The problem comes in the hours when he isn't working, when his thoughts start blowing out the open window of his brain like pages from a blotter. Sometimes it takes a heavy paperweight to pin them down. "I hate to make more work for you," Tenenbaum says. During his days working narcotics, Lantzman arrested Tenenbaum 5 times. That is all the basis for what passes for friendship between them. It is almost enough. "It's not work, Tenenbaum," Lantzman says. "I do it for love." "It's the same for me," the night manager says, "with being a night manager of a crap-ass hotel." Lantzman puts his hand on Tenenbaum's shoulder, and they go down to take stock of the deceased squeezing into the Zamenhof's lone elevator, or elevatoro, as a small brass plate over the door would have it. When the hotel was built 50 years ago, all of its directional signs, labels, notices, and warnings were printed on brass plates in Esperanto. Most of them are long gone, victims of neglect, vandalism, or the fire code. The door and doorframe of 208 do not exhibit signs of forced entry. Lantzman covers the knob with his handkerchief and nudges the door open with the toe of his loafer.
"I got this funny feeling," Tenenbaum says as he follows Lantzman into the room.
"First time I ever saw the guy. You know the expression, a broken man?"
Lantzman allows that the phrase rings a bell.
"Most of the people it gets applied to don't really deserve it," Tenenbaum says. "Most men, in my opinion, they have nothing there to break in the first place. But this Lasker, he was like one of those sticks you snap. It lights up, you know, for a few hours, and you can hear broken glass rattling inside of it. I don't know, forget it. It was just a funny feeling." "Everybody has a funny feeling these days," Lantzman says, making a few notes in his little black pad about the situation of the room, even though such notes are superfluous, because he rarely forgets a detail of physical description. Lantzman has been told by the same loose confederacy of physicians, psychologists, and his former spouse that alcohol will kill his gift for recollection, but so far, to his regret, this claim has proved false. His vision of the past remains unimpaired. "We had to open up a separate phone line just to handle the calls." "These are strange times to be a Jew," Tenenbaum agrees. "No doubt about it." A small pile of paperback books sits atop the laminate dresser. On the bedside table, Lasker kept a chessboard. It looks like he had a game going, a messy-looking middle game with Black's king under attack at the center of the board and White having the advantage of a couple of pieces. It's a cheap set, the board a square of card that folds down the middle, the pieces hollow, with plastic nubs where they were extruded. One light burns in a three-shade floor lamp by the television. Every other bulb in the room, apart from the bathroom tube, has been removed or allowed to burn out. On the windowsill sits a package of a popular brand of over-the-counter laxative. The window is cranked open its possible inch, and every few seconds the metal blinds bang in the stiff wind blowing in off the Gulf of Alaska. The wind carries a sour tang of pulped lumber, the smell of boat diesel, and the slaughter and canning of salmon. According to Nok Amol, a song that Lantzman and every other Alaskan Jew of his generation learned in grade school, the smell of the wind from the Gulf fills a Jewish nose with a sense of promise, opportunity, the chance to start again. Nok Amol dates from the polar bear days, the early 40s, and it's supposed to be an expression of gratitude for another miraculous deliverance, once again. Nowadays, the Jews of the Sitka district tend to hear the ironic edge that was there all along. "Seems like I've known a lot of chess-playing Yids who used smack," Tenenbaum says.
"Same here," Lantzman says, looking down at the deceased,
realizing he has seen the Yid around the Zamenhof. Little bird of a man, bright eye, snub beak, bit of a flush in the cheeks and throat that might have been rosacea. Not a hard case, not a scumbag, not quite a lost soul.
A Yid not too different from Lantzman, maybe, apart from his choice of drug.
Clean fingernails, always a tie and hat. Read a book with footnotes once. Now Lasker lies on his belly, on the pull-down bed, face to the wall, wearing only a pair of regulation white underpants. Ginger hair and ginger freckles and 3 days of golden stubble on his cheek. A trace of a double chin that Lantzman puts down to a vanished life as a fat boy. Eyes swollen in their blood-dark orbits. At the back of his head is a small burnt hole, a bead of blood. No sign of a struggle. Nothing to indicate that Lasker saw it coming or even knew the instant when it came. The pillow, Lantzman notices, is missing from the bed. "If I'd known, maybe I would have proposed a game or two." "I didn't know you play."
"I'm weak," Lantzman says.
By the closet, on plush carpet, the medicated yellow-green of a throat lozenge, he spots a tiny white feather. Lantzman jerks open the closet door, and there on the floor is the pillow, shot through the heart to silence the concussion of bursting gases in his shell. "I have no feel for the middle game." "In my experience, detective," Tenenbaum says, "it's all middle game." "Don't I know it," Lantzman says. He calls to wake his partner, Berko Shemitz.
"Detective Shemitz," Lantzman says into his mobile phone. "A department issue chauffeur AT.
"This is your partner." "I begged you not to do this anymore, Meyer," Berko says. Needless to say, he also has 8 hours to go until his next shift. "You have a right to be angry," Lantzman says, "only I thought maybe you might still be awake."
"I was awake."
Unlike Lantzman, Berko Shemitz has not made a mess of his marriage or his personal life.
Every night he sleeps in the arms of his excellent wife, whose love for him is merited, requited, and appreciated by her husband, a steadfast man who never gives her any cause for sorrow or alarm. "A curse on your head, Meyer," Berko says, and then in American, "God damn it." "I have an apparent homicide here at my hotel," Lonsman says. "A resident. A single shot to the back of the head, silenced with a pillow. Very tidy." "A hit. That's the only reason I'm bothering you. The unusual nature of the killing." Sitka, with a population in the long, jagged strip of the metro area of 3.2 million, averages about 75 homicides a year. Some of these are gang-related. Russian stalkers whacking one another freestyle. The rest of Sitka's homicides are so-called crimes of passion, which is a shorthand way of expressing the mathematical product of alcohol and firearms. Cold-blooded executions are as rare as they are tough to clear from the big whiteboard in the squad room, where the tally of open cases is kept. "You're off duty, Meyer. Call it in. Give it to Tabachnik and Karpis." Tabachnik and Karpis, the other two detectives who make up B-Squad in the homicide section of the District Police Sitka headquarters, are holding down the night shift this month. Lutzman has to acknowledge a certain appeal in the idea of letting this pigeon shit on their fedoras. "Well, I would," Lutzman says, "except for this is my place of residence." "You knew him?" Berko says, his tone softening. "No," Lutzman says, "I did not know the Yid." He looks away from the pale, freckled expanse of the dead man stretched out on the pull-down bed. Sometimes he can't help feeling sorry for them, but it's better not to get into the habit. "Look," Lonsman says, "you go back to bed. We can talk about it tomorrow. I'm sorry I bothered you. Good night. Tell Esther Malke I'm sorry." "You sound a little off, Meyer," Berko says. "You okay?" In recent months, Lonsman has placed a number of calls to his partner at questionable hours of the night, ranting and rambling in an alcoholic dialect of grief. Lonsman bailed out on his marriage 2 years ago, and last April his younger sister crashed her Piper Super Cub into the side of Mount Dunkelblum, up in the bush. But Lonsman is not thinking of Naomi's death now, nor of the shame of his divorce. He has been sandbagged by a vision of sitting in the grimy lounge of the Hotel Zamenhof, on a couch that was once white, playing chess with Emanuel Lasker, or whatever his real name was, shedding the last of their fading glow on each other and listening to the sweet chiming of broken glass inside. That Lonsman loathes the game of chess does not make the picture any less touching. "The guy played chess, Berko. I never knew, that's all." "Please," Berko says. "Please, Meyer, I beg you, don't start with the crying." "I'm fine," Lonsman says. "Good night." Lonsman calls the dispatcher to make himself the primary detective on the Lasker case. Another piece of shit homicide is not going to put any special hurt on his clearance rate as primary. Not that it really matters. On the 1st of January, sovereignty over the whole federal district of Sitka, a crooked parenthesis of rocky shoreline running along the western edges of Baranof and Chichagov Islands, will revert to the state of Alaska. The district police, to which Lonsman has devoted his hide, head, and soul for 20 years, will be dissolved. It is far from clear that Lonsman or Berko Shemitz or anybody else will be keeping his job. Nothing is clear about the upcoming reversion, and that is why these are strange times to be a Jew. 2. While he waits for the beat lotka to show, Lonsman knocks on doors. Most of the occupants in the Zamenhof are out for the night, in body or mind, and for all that he gets out of the rest of them, he might as well be knocking on doors at the Hershkovitz School for the Deaf. They are a twitchy, half-addled, rankin', cranky bunch of Yids, the residents of the Hotel Zamenhof, but none of them seems any more disturbed than usual tonight, and none of them strikes Lonsman as the type to jam a large-caliber handgun against the base of a man's skull and kill him in stone-cold blood. "I'm wasting my time with these buffaloes," Lonsman tells Tenenbaum. "And you sure you didn't see anybody or anything out of the ordinary?" "I'm sorry, detective." "You're a buffalo, too, Tenenbaum. I don't dispute the charge." "The service door?" "Dealers were using it," Tenenbaum says. "We had to put in an alarm." "I would have heard." Lonsman gets Tenenbaum to telephone the day manager and the weekend man, snug at home in their beds. These gentlemen agree with Tenenbaum that, as far as they know, no one has called for the dead man or asked after him. Ever. Not during the entire course of his stay at the Zamenhof. No visitors, no friends, not even the delivery boy from Pearl of Manila.
So, Lonsman thinks, there's a difference between him and Lasker.
Lonsman has occasional visits from Rommel bearing a brown paper bag of lumpia.
"I'm going to check out the roof," Lonsman says. Don't let anybody leave and call me when the Latka decides to show up. Lantzman rides the elevatoro to the 8th floor and then bangs his way up a flight of steel-edged concrete steps to the roof of the Zamenhof.
He walks the perimeter, looking across Max Nordau Street to the roof of the Blackpool. He peers over the north, east, and south cornices to the surrounding low structures 6 or 7 stories down. Night is an orange smear over Sitka, a compound of fog and the light of sodium vapor street lamps. It has the translucence of onions cooked in chicken fat. The lamps of the Jews stretch from the slope of Mount Edgecombe in the west over the 72 infilled islands of the Sound, across the Schwarzenjam, Halibut Point, South Sitka, and the Nachtassel, across Harkovy and the Unterstadt before they are snuffed in the east by the Baranoff Range. On Oysterlung Island, the beacon at the tip of the safety pin, sole remnant of the World's Fair, blinks out its warning to airplanes or Yids. Lantzman can smell fish offal from the canneries, grease from the fry pits at Pearl of Manila, the spew of taxis, an intoxicating bouquet of fresh hat from Grinspoon's Felting 2 blocks away. It's nice up there, Lantzman says, when he gets back down to the lobby, with its ashtray charm, the yellowing sofas, the scarred chairs and tables at which you sometimes see a couple of hotel residents killing an hour with a game of pinochle. Might should go up more often. What about the basement, Tenenbaum says. You gonna look down there? The basement, Lantzman says, and his heart describes a sudden night move in his chest. I guess I better. Lantzman is a tough guy in his way, given to the taking of wild chances. He's been called hard-boiled and foolhardy, a momser, a crazy son of a bitch. He has faced down stalkers and psychopaths, has been shot at, beaten, frozen, burned. He has pursued suspects between the flashing walls of urban firefights and deep into bear country. Heights, crowds, snakes, burning houses, dogs schooled to hate the smell of a policeman. He has shrugged them all off or functioned in spite of them. But when he finds himself in lightless or confined spaces,
something in the animal core of Meyer Lantzman convulses. No one but his ex-wife knows it, but Detective Meyer Lantzman is afraid of the dark.
"Want me to go with you?" Tenenbaum says, sounding offhand. But you never know with a sensitive old fishwife like Tenenbaum.
Lantzman affects to scorn the offer.
"Just give me a damn flashlight," he says. The basement exhales its breath of camphor, heating oil, and coal dust. Lantzman jerks a string that lights a naked bulb, holds his breath, and goes under. At the bottom of the steps, he passes through the lost articles room, lined with pegboard, furnished with shelves and cubbyholes that hold the 1,000 objects abandoned or forgotten in the hotel. Unmated shoes, fur hats, a trumpet, a wind-up zeppelin, a collection of wax gramophone cylinders featuring the entire recorded output of the Orchestra Orpheon of Istanbul, a logger's axe, 2 bicycles, a partial bridge, and a hotel glass. Wigs, canes, a glass eye, display hands left behind by a mannequin salesman. Prayer books, prayer shawls in their velvet zipper pouches, an outlandish idol with the body of a fat baby and the head of an elephant. There is a wooden soft drink crate filled with keys, another with the entire range and breadth of hairstyling tools, from irons to eyelash crimpers. Framed photographs of families in better days. A cryptic twist of rubber that might be a sex toy or a contraceptive device, or the patented secret of a foundation garment. Some yet even left behind a taxidermy marten, sleek and leering, its glass eye a hard bead of ink. Lantzman probes the box of keys with a pencil. He looks inside each hat, gropes along the shelves behind the abandoned paperback books. He can hear his own heart and smell his own aldehyde breath. And after a few minutes in the silence, the sound of blood in his ears begins to remind him of somebody talking. He checks behind the hot water tanks, lashed to one another with straps of steel like comrades in a doomed adventure. The laundry is next. When he pulls the string for the light, nothing happens. It's 10 degrees darker in here, and there's nothing to see but blank walls, severed hookups, drain holes in the floor. The Zamenhof has not done its own wash in years. Lantzman looks into the drain holes, and the darkness in them is oily and thick. Lantzman feels a flutter, a worm in his belly. He flexes his fingers and cracks the bones of his neck. At the far end of the laundry room, a door that is 3 planks nailed together by a diagonal 4th seals a low doorway. The wooden door has a loop of rope for a latch and a peg to hook it on. A crawl space.
Lantzman half dreads the phrase alone.
He calculates the chance that a certain style of killer, not a professional, not a true amateur, not even a normal maniac, might be hiding in that crawl space. Possible. but it would be pretty tough for the freak to have hooked the loop over the peg from inside. That logic alone is almost enough to persuade him not to bother with the crawlspace. In the end, Lantzman switches on the flash and notches it between his teeth. He hikes up his pant legs and gets down on his knees. Just to spite himself, because spiting himself, spiting others, spiting the world is the pastime and only patrimony of Lantzman and his people. With one hand he unholsters his big little S&W, and with the other he fingers the loop of rope. He yanks open the door of the crawlspace. "Come out," he says, lips dry, rasping like a scared old fart. The elation he experienced on the roof is cooled like blown filament. His nights are wasted, his life and career a series of mistakes, his city itself a bulb that is about to go black. He thrusts his upper body into the crawlspace. The air is cold with the bitter smell of mouse shit. The beam of the pocket flash dribbles over everything, shadowing as much as it reveals. Walls of cinder block, an earthen floor, the ceiling a loathsome tangle of wires and foam insulation. In the middle of the dirt floor at the back, a disc of raw plywood lies set in a circular metal frame, flush with the floor. Lantzman holds his breath and swims through his panic to the hole in the floor, determined to stay under for as long as he can. The dirt around the frame is undisturbed. An even layer of dust lies over wood and metal alike. No marks, no streaks. There is no reason to think anyone has been fooling with it. Lantzman fits his fingernails between the plywood and the frame and pries off the crude hatch. The flashlight reveals a threaded tube of aluminum screwed into the earth, laddered with steel cleats. The frame turns out to be the edge of the tube itself, just wide enough to admit a full-grown psychopath, or a Jewish policeman with fewer phobias than Lantzman. He clings to the shalom as to a handle, wrestling with a crazy need to fire it into the throat of the darkness. He drops the plywood disc back into its frame with a clatter. No way is he going down there. The darkness follows him all the way back up the stairs to the lobby, reaching for his collar, tugging at his sleeve. "Nothing," he tells Tenenbaum, pulling himself together. He gives the word a cheery ring. It might be a prediction of what his investigation into the murder of Emmanuel Lasker is bound to reveal, a statement of what he believes Lasker lived for and died for, a realization of what will remain after the reversion of Lantzman's hometown. "Nothing." "You know what Cohn says," says Tenenbaum. "Cohn says we got a ghost in the house." Cohn is the day manager. "Taking shit, moving shit around. Cohn figures it for the ghost of Professor Zamenhof." "If they named a dump like this after me," Lantzman says, "I'd haunt it too." "You never know," Tenenbaum observes, "especially nowadays." "Nowadays one never knows. Out at Pavarotny, a cat mated with a rabbit and produced adorable freaks whose photos graced the front page of the Sitka Tog. Last February, 500 witnesses all up and down the district swore that in the shimmer of the Aurora Borealis, for two nights running, they observed the outlines of a human face, with beard and sidelocks. Violent arguments broke out over the identity of the bearded sage in the sky, whether or not the face was smiling, or merely suffering from a mild attack of gas, and the meaning of the weird manifestation. And just last week, amid the panic and feathers of a kosher slaughterhouse on Shidlovsky Avenue, a chicken turned on the shochet as he raised his ritual knife and announced in Aramaic the imminent advent of Messiah. According to the Tog, the miraculous chicken offered a number of startling predictions, though it neglected to mention the soup in which, having once more fallen silent as God himself, it afterward featured. Even the most casual study of the record, Lantzman thinks, would show that strange times to be a Jew have almost always been, as well, strange times to be a chicken. 3. In the street, the wind shakes rain from the flaps of its overcoat. Lantzman tucks himself into the hotel doorway. Two men, one with a cello case strapped to his back, the other cradling a violin or viola, struggle against the weather toward the door of Pearl of Manila across the street. The Symphony Hall is 10 blocks and a world away from this end of Max Nordau Street, but the craving of a Jew for pork, in particular when it has been deep-fried, is a force greater than night or distance or a cold blast off the Gulf of Alaska. Lantzman himself is fighting the urge to return to room 505 and his bottle of Slivovitz and his World's Fair souvenir glass. Instead, he lights a papyrus. After a decade of abstinence, Lantzman took up smoking again not quite 3 years ago. His then-wife was pregnant at the time. It was a much-discussed and in some quarters a long-desired pregnancy, her first, but not a planned one. As with many pregnancies that are discussed too long, there was a history of ambivalence in the prospective father. At 17 weeks and a day, the date Lantzman bought his first package of Broadways in 10 years, they got a bad result. Some, but not all, of the cells that made up the fetus, codenamed Django, had an extra chromosome on the 20th pair. A mosaicism, it was called. It might cause grave abnormalities. It might have no effect at all. In the available literature, a faithful person could find encouragement, and a faithless one, ample reason to despond. Lanzmann's view of things, ambivalent, despondent, and with no faith in anything, prevailed. A doctor with half a dozen laminaria dilators broke the seal on the life of Django Lanzmann. 3 months later, Lanzmann and his cigarettes moved out of the house on Chernovitz Island that he and Bina had shared for nearly all of the 15 years of their marriage. It was not that he couldn't live with the guilt. He just couldn't live with it and Bina, too. An old man, pushing himself like a rickety handcart, weaves a course toward the door of the hotel. A short man, under 5 feet, dragging a large valise. Lanzmann observes the long white coat, worn open over a white suit with a waistcoat, and the wide-brimmed white hat pulled down over his ears. A white beard and sidelocks, wispy and thick at the same time. The valise, an ancient chimera of stained brocade and scratched hide. The whole right side of the man's body sags 5 degrees lower than the left, where the suitcase, which must contain the old boy's entire collection of lead ingots, weighs it down. The man stops and raises a finger, as if he has a question to pose of Lanzmann. The wind toys with the man's whiskers and with the brim of his hat. From his beard, armpits, breath, and skin, the wind plucks a rich smell of stale tobacco and wet flannel and the sweat of a man who lives in the street. Lanzmann notes the color of the man's antiquated boots, yellowish ivory, like his beard, with sharp toes and buttons running up the sides. Lanzmann recalls that he used to see this nut a lot, back when he was arresting Tenenbaum for petty theft and possession. The Yid was no younger then and is no older now. People used to call him Elijah because he turned up in all kinds of unlikely spots, with his pushki box and his indefinable air of having something important to say. "Darling," he says to Lanzmann now, "this is the Hotel Zamenhof, no?" His Yiddish sounds a bit exotic to Lanzmann, flavored with Dutch, maybe. He is bent and frail, but his face, apart from crow's feet around the blue eyes, looks youthful and unlined. The eyes themselves hold a match flame of eagerness that puzzles Lanzmann. The prospect of a night at the Zamenhof does not often give rise to such anticipation. "That's right." Lanzmann offers Elijah the Prophet of Broadway, and the little man takes two and tucks one into the reliquary of his breast pocket. "Hot and cold water, licensed shamus, right on the premises." "Are you the manager, sweetness?" Lanzmann can't help smiling at that. He steps aside, gesturing toward the door. "The manager's inside," he says. But the little man just stands there, getting rained on, his beard fluttering like a flag of truce. He gazes up at the faceless face of the Zamenhof, gray in the murky streetlight. A narrow pile of dirty white brick and slit windows, 3 or 4 blocks off the tawdry stretch of Monastir Street. The place has all the allure of a dehumidifier. Its neon sign blinks on and off, tormenting the dreams of the losers across the street at the Blackpool. "The Zamenhof," the old man says, echoing the intermittent letters on the neon sign. "Not the Zamenhof. The Zamenhof." Now the Latka, a rookie named Netsky, comes jogging up, holding on to his round, flat, wide-brimmed patrolman's hat. "Detective," the Latka says, out of breath, and then gives the old man a squint and a nod. "Evening, Grandpa." "Right, detective, sorry, I just got the call. I was hung up for a minute there." Netsky has coffee on his breath and powdered sugar on the right cuff of his blue suit. "Where's the dead Yid?" "In 208, Lanzmann says, opening the door for the Latka, then turning back to the old man. "Coming in, Grandpa?" "No," Elijah says, with a hint of mild emotion that Lanzmann can't quite read. It might be regret, or relief, or the grim satisfaction of a man with a taste for disappointment. The flicker trapped in the old man's eyes has given way to a film of tears.
"I was only curious."
"Thank you, Officer Lanzmann."
"It's detective now," Lanzmann says, startled that the old man has retrieved his name. "You remember me, Grandpa?"
"I remember everything, darling."
Elijah reaches into a hip pocket of his bleach-yellow coat and takes out his pushki, a wooden casket, about the size of a box meant for index cards, painted black. On the front of the box, Hebrew words are painted. Loretz Yisrael. Cut into the top of the box is a narrow slit for coins or a folded dollar bill.
"A small donation," Elijah says.
The Holy Land has never seemed more remote or unattainable than it does to a Jew of Sitka. It is on the far side of the planet, a wretched place ruled by men united only in the resolve to keep out all but a worn fistful of small-change Jews. For half a century, Arab strongmen and Muslim partisans, Persians and Egyptians, socialists and nationalists and monarchists, pan-Arabists and pan-Islamists, traditionalists and the party of Ali have all sunk their teeth into Eretz Yisrael and worried it down to bone and gristle. Jerusalem is a city of blood and slogans painted on the wall, severed heads on telephone poles. Observant Jews around the world have not abandoned their hope to dwell one day in the land of Zion. But Jews have been tossed out of the joint three times now, in 586 BCE, in 70 CE, and with savage finality in 1948. It's hard even for the faithful not to feel a sense of discouragement about their chances of once again getting a foot in the door. Lantzman gets out his wallet and pokes a folded 20 into Elijah's pushkey. Lots of luck, he says. The little man hoists his heavy valise and starts to shuffle away. Lantzman reaches out and pulls at Elijah's sleeve, a question formulating in his heart, a child's question about the old wish of his people for a home. Elijah turns with a look of practiced wariness. Maybe Lantzman is some kind of troublemaker. Lantzman feels the question ebb away like the nicotine in his bloodstream. What you got in the bag, Grandpa? Lantzman says. Looks heavy. It's a book. One book? It's very big. Long story? Very long. What's it about? It's about Messiah, Elijah says. Now please, take your hand off of me. Lantzman lets go. The old man straightens his back and raises his head. The clouds in his eyes blow over, and he looks angry, disdainful, and not in the least old. Messiah is coming, he says. It isn't quite a warning, and yet, somehow, as a promise of redemption, it lacks a certain warmth.
That works out well, Lantzman says, jerking his thumb toward the hotel lobby.
As of tonight, we have a vacancy. Elijah looks hurt, or maybe just disgusted. He opens the black box and looks inside. He takes out the $20 bill that Lantzman gave him and hands it back. Then he picks up his suitcase, settles his floppy white hat down over his head, and trudges off into the rain. Lantzman crumples the 20 and drops it into his hip pocket. He grinds his papyrus under his shoe and goes into the hotel. "Who's the nut?" Netsky says. "They call him Elijah. He's harmless," says Tenenbaum from behind the steel mesh of the reception window. "You used to see him around sometimes, always pimping for Messiah." Tenenbaum clacks a gold toothpick against his molars. "Listen, detective, I'm not supposed to say anything, but I might as well tell you. Management is sending out a letter tomorrow." "I can't wait to hear this," Lantzman says. "The owner sold out to a Kansas City concern." "They're tossing us." "Maybe," Tenenbaum says. "Maybe not. Nobody's status is clear, but it's not out of the question that you might have to move out." "Is that what it's going to say in the letter?" Tenenbaum shrugs. "The letter's all written in lawyer." Lantzman puts Netsky the Lotka on the front door. "Don't tell them what they heard or saw," he reminds him. "And don't give them a hard time, even if they look like they could use one." Menashe Springer, the criminologist working the graveyard shift, blows into the lobby in a black coat and fur hat, with a rattling of rain. In one hand, Springer carries a dripping umbrella. With the other, he tows a chrome caddy to which his black vinyl toolbox and a plastic bin, with holes for handles, are strapped with bungee cord. Springer is a fireplug, his bowed legs and simian arms affixed to his neck without apparent benefit of shoulders. His face is mostly jowl, and his ridged forehead looks like one of those domed beehives you see representing industry in medieval woodcuts. The bin is blazoned with the single word, evidence, in blue letters. "Are you leaving town?" Springer says. It's not an uncommon greeting these days. A lot of people have left town in the past couple of years, fled the district for the short roster of places that will welcome them, or that have tired of hearing about pogroms secondhand and are hoping to throw one for themselves. Lantzman says that as far as he knows, he is not going anywhere. Most of the places that will take Jews require that you have a near relative living there. All of Lantzman's nearest relatives are dead or facing reversion themselves. "Then let me say goodbye to you now forever," Springer says. "Tomorrow night at this time I will be basking in the warm Saskatchewan sun."
"Saskatoon," Lantzman guesses.
30 below they had today, Springer says. That was the high.
"Look at it this way," Lantzman says. "You could be living in this dump."
The Zamenhof. In his memory, Springer pulls Lantzman's file and frowns at its contents. "That's right. Home sweet home, eh? It suits me in my current style of life." Springer smiles a thin smile from which almost every trace of pity has been erased. "Which way to the dead man?" he says.
4. First thing, Springer screws in all the light bulbs that Lasker loosened. Then he lowers his safety glasses and goes to work. He gives Lasker a manicure and pedicure and looks inside his mouth for a severed finger or a bronze doubloon. He lifts prints with his dust and brush and takes 317 Polaroids. He takes pictures of the corpse, the room, the perforated pillow, the fingerprints he has raised. He takes a picture of the chessboard.
"One for me," Lonsman says.
Springer snaps a second shot of the board that the murder obliged Lasker to abandon.
Then he hands it to Lonsman, an eyebrow raised.
"Valuable clue," Lonsman says.
One piece at a time, Springer undoes the dead man's Nimzo Croatian defense, or whatever it is he had going, zipping each chessman into its own baggie.
"How'd you get so dirty?" he says without looking at Lonsman.
Lonsman notices the bright brown dust clinging to his shoe tops, his cuffs, the knees of his pants. "I was looking in the basement. There's a huge, service pipe down there." He feels the blood flow into his cheeks. "I had to check it out."
"A Warsaw Tunnel," Springer says.
"They go all through this part of the Unterstadt."
"You don't believe that.
When the Greeners got here after the war, the ones who had been in the ghetto at Warsaw, at Bialystok, the ex-partisans, I guess some of them didn't trust the Americans very much, so they dug tunnels, just in case they had to fight again. That's the real reason it's called the Unterstadt."
"A rumor, Springer. An urban myth. It's just a utility pipe."
Springer grunts. He bags the bath towel, the hand towel, and a worn tile of soap. He counts the ginger pubic hairs pasted to the toilet seat and then bags each one.
"Speaking of rumors," he says, "what do you hear from Felsenfeld?"
"Felsenfeld is Inspector Felsenfeld, the squad commander."
"What do you mean, what do I hear from him? I just saw him this afternoon," Lonsman says. "I didn't hear anything from him. The man hasn't uttered three words together in 10 years. What kind of question is that? What rumors?"
"Just wondering."
Springer is running his fingers in their latex glove across the freckled skin of Lasker's left arm. It bears needle tracks and faint marks where the deceased tied himself off.
"Felsenfeld's hand was on his belly all day," Lonsman says, reflecting. "Maybe I heard him say reflux."
"Then, what do you see?"
Springer frowns at the flesh above Lasker's elbow, where the tourniquet marks are bunched.
"Looks like he used a belt," he says. "Only his belt is too wide to have made these marks."
He has already put Lasker's belt, along with 2 pairs of gray trousers and 2 blue blazers, into a brown paper bag.
"His works are in the drawer in a black zip," Lonsman says. "I didn't look too close."
Springer opens the drawer on Lasker's bedside table and takes out the black toilet kit. He unzips it and then makes a funny sound in his throat. The cover of the kit opens towards Lonsman. At first, Lonsman can't see what has caught Springer's interest. Lonsman can't help thinking that he first made love to his future ex-wife in July 1986. Bina was 20 at the time, and Lonsman was 23, and it was the height of the northern summer. July 1986 is the date stamped onto the card in the pocket of Lonsman's illusions. The other 2 books are cheap Yiddish thrillers. "Beyond that, I know goat shit." As Springer has inferred from the marks on Lasker's arm, the deceased's apparent tourniquet of choice was a leather strap, black, about 1/2 inch wide. Springer pulls it out of the zip and holds it up between 2 fingers as if it might bite. Halfway along the strap hangs a small leather box designed to hold a slip of paper on which a scribe, with ink and a feather, has written 4 passages from the Torah. Each morning the pious Jew twines one of these doodads along his left arm, ties another to his forehead, and prays for understanding of the kind of God who obliges somebody to do something like that every damn day of his life. But there is nothing inside the box on Emanuel Lasker's prayer strap. It's just the thing he chose to use to dilate the vein in his arm.
"That's a new one," Springer says, "tying off with tefillin."
"Now that I think about it," Lonsman says, "he had the look.
Like maybe he used to be Black Hat. They take on a kind of a, they look shorn."
Lonsman pulls on a glove and, gripping Lasker's chin, tilts from side to side the dead man's head with its swollen mask of blood vessels. "If he used to wear a beard, then it was a while ago," he says. "Skin tone on his face is even." He lets go of Lasker's face and steps away from the body. It would not be quite accurate to say that he pegged Lasker for a former Black Hat. but with the chin of a fat boy and the air of ruination, Lonsman figured Lasker for having once been something more than a sockless junkie in a cheap hotel. He sighs. What I wouldn't give to be lying on the sunny beaches of Saskatoon. There are noises in the hallway and the rattle of metal and straps, and the next moment two workers from the morgue come in with a collapsible gurney. Springer tells them to bring the evidence bin and the bags he has filled, and then lumbers out, one wheel of his trolley squeaking as he goes.
Piece of shit, Lonsman informs the morgue boys, meaning the case, not the victim.
This judgment does not appear to surprise or come to them as news.
Lonsman goes back up to his room to rejoin his bottle of Slivovitz and the World's Fair shot glass that has captured his affections.
He sits down in the chair by the pressboard desk with a dirty shirt for a seat cushion. He takes the Polaroid out of his pocket and studies the game that Lasker left behind, trying to decide whether the next move was to be whites or blacks, and what would be the next move after that. But there are too many pieces, and it is too difficult to hold the moves in his head, and Lonsman doesn't own anything like a chess set on which to lay it all out. After a few minutes, he feels himself drifting off to sleep. But now he isn't going to do that, not when he knows that what awaits him are trite Escher dreams, woozy checkerboards, giant rooks casting phallic shadows. He takes off his clothes and steps under the shower and lies down for half an hour with his eyes wide open, taking memories of his little sister and her super cub, of Beaner in the summer of 1986, out of their plastic bags. He studies them as if they are transcriptions in a dusty book stolen from the library, of bygone checkmates and brilliancies. After half an hour of that useful pursuit, he gets up and puts on a clean shirt and tie, and goes down to Sitka Central to file his report.
5. Lonsman learned to hate the game of chess at the hands of his father and his uncle Hertz.
The brothers-in-law were boyhood friends back in Lodz, fellow members of the Maccabee Youth Chess Club.
Lonsman remembers how they used to talk about the day in the summer of 1939 when the great Tartakow had dropped by to put on a demonstration for the boys of the Maccabee.
Savili Tartakow was a Polish citizen, a grandmaster, and a character famous for having said, "The blunders are all there on the board, waiting to be made." He came from Paris to report in a tournament for a French chess journal and to visit with the directors of the Maccabee Youth Chess Club, an old comrade from his days on the Russian front in the army of Franz Joseph. At the director's urging, Tartakower now proposed a game against the club's best young player,
Isidore Lonsman.
They sat down together, the strapping war veteran in his bespoke suit and harsh good humor, and the stammering 15-year-old with a wall eye, a receding hairline, and a mustache that was often mistaken for a sooty thumbprint.
Tartakower drew black, and Lonsman's father chose the English opening.
For the first hour, Tartakower's play was inattentive, even automatic. He left his great chess engine idling and played by the book.
34 moves in, with genial scorn, he offered Lonsman's father a draw. Lonsman's father needed to piss. His ears were ringing. He was only staving off the inevitable.
But he declined. His game by now was based on nothing but feel and desperation. He reacted. He refused exchanges, his sole assets, a stubborn nature, and a wild sense of the board. After 70 moves and 4 hours and 10 minutes of play, Tartakower, not so genial anymore, repeated his earlier offer.
Lonsman's father, plagued by tinnitus, about to wet his pants, accepted. In later years, Lonsman's father sometimes let on that his mind, that queer organ, never quite recovered from the ordeal of this game.
But, of course, there were worse ordeals to come. That was not in the least enjoyable, Tartakower is supposed to have told Lonsman's father, rising from his chair. Young Hertz Shemitz, with his unfailing eye for weakness, spotted a tremor in Tartakower's hand, holding a hastily fetched glass of Tokay.
Then Tartakower pointed to Isidore Lonsman's skull.
But I'm sure it was preferable to being obliged to live in there. Not quite 2 years later, Hertz Shemitz, his mother, and his kid sister Fradel arrived on Baranoff Island, Alaska, with the first wave of Galitzer settlers. He came on the notorious Diamond, a World War I-era troop transport that Secretary Ickes ordered taken out of mothballs and rechristened as a left-handed memorial, or so legend has it, to the late Anthony Dimmon, the Alaska Territory's non-voting delegate to the House of Representatives. Until the fatal intervention on a Washington, D.C. street corner of a drunken taxi-driving schlemiel named Denny Lanning, eternal hero of the Sitka Jews, Delegate Dimon had been on the verge of getting the Alaska Settlement Act killed in committee. Thin, pale, bewildered, Hurt Shemet stepped from the diamond, from the dark and the reek of soup and rusty puddles, to the clean, cold spice of Sitka pine. With his family and his people, he was numbered, inoculated, deloused, tagged like a migrant bird by the stipulations of the Alaskan Settlement Act of 1940. In a cardboard pocketbook, he carried an Ickes passport, a special emergency visa printed on special flimsy paper with special smeary ink. There was nowhere else for him to go. It said so in large type on the front of the Ickes passport. He would not be permitted to travel to Seattle or San Francisco or even Juneau or Ketchikan. All the normal quotas on Jewish immigration to the United States remained in force. Even with the timely death of Dimon, the act could not be forced up the American body politic without a certain amount of muscle and grease, and restrictions on Jewish movement were part of the deal. On the heels of Jews from Germany and Austria, the Shemetz family was dumped with their fellow Galitzers at Camp Slattery, in a muskeg swamp 10 miles from the hard-bitten, half-decrepit town of Sitka, capital of the old Russian Alaska colony. In drafty, tin-roofed huts and barracks, they underwent 6 months of intensive acclimatization by a crack team of 15 billion mosquitoes working under contract with the U.S. Interior Department. Hertz was conscripted for a road gang, then assigned to the crew that built the Sitka airfield. He lost 2 molars when he was smacked by a shovel, working a muck detail deep in a caisson sunk in the mud of Sitka Harbor. In later years, whenever you drove with him over the Chernovitz Bridge, he would rub at his jaw, and his hard eyes and his sharp face would take on a wistful air. Fradel was sent to school in a chilly barn whose roof rang with steady rain. Their mother was taught the rudiments of agriculture, the use of plow, fertilizer, and irrigation hose. Brochures and posters held up the short Alaskan growing season as an allegory of the brief duration of her stay. Mrs. Shemetz ought to think of the Sitka settlement as a cellar or potting shed in which, like flower bulbs, she and her children could be put up for the winter until their home soil thawed enough to allow them to be replanted there. No one imagined that the soil of Europe would be sowed so deeply with salt and ash. Despite the agricultural palaver, the modest homesteads and farm cooperatives proposed by the Sitka Settlement Corporation never materialized. Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. The Interior Department's attention wandered toward more pressing strategic concerns, such as oil reserves and mining. At the conclusion of their term at Ickes College, the Shemetz family, like most of their fellow refugees, were kicked loose to fend for themselves. Just as Delegate Dimon had predicted, they drifted up to the raw, newly booming town of Sitka. Hertz studied criminal justice at the new Sitka Technical Institute, and on graduating in 1948, was hired by a paralegal by the first big U.S. law firm to open a branch office here. His sister Freda, Lonsman's mother, was among the earliest Girl Scouts in the settlement. 1948. Strange times to be a Jew. In August, the defense of Jerusalem collapsed, and the outnumbered Jews of the 3-month-old Republic of Israel were routed, massacred, and driven into the sea. As Hertz was starting his job at Fein, Harmattan, and Baran, the House Committee on Territories and Insular Affairs began a long-delayed review of status called for by the Sitka Settlement Act. Like the rest of Congress, like most Americans, the House Committee was sobered by grim revelations of the slaughter of 2 million Jews in Europe, by the barbarity of the rout of Zionism, by the plight of the refugees of Palestine and Europe. At the same time, they were practical souls. The population of Sitka Settlement had already swollen to 2 million. In direct violation of the act, Jews had spread up and down the western shore of Baranof Island, out to Krutsov, all the way up to West Chichagof Island. The economy was booming. American Jews were lobbying hard. In the end, Congress granted the Sitka Settlement interim status as a federal district. But candidacy for separate statehood was explicitly ruled out. "No Jewlaska," lawmakers promised, ran the headline in the Daily Times. The emphasis was always on the word interim. In 60 years, that status would revert, and the Sitka Jews would be left once again to shift for themselves. One warm September afternoon, not long after, Hert Shemetz was walking down Seward Street, prolonging his lunch break, when he bumped into his old chum from Lodz, Isidor Lonsman. Lonsman's father had just arrived in Sitka, alone, aboard the Willowaw, fresh from a tour of the death and DP camps of Europe. He was 25, bald, and missing most of his teeth. He was 6 feet tall and weighed 125 pounds. He smelled funny, talked crazy, and had outlived his entire family. He was oblivious to the raucous frontier energy of downtown Sitka, the work crews of young Jewesses in their blue headscarves, singing Negro spirituals with Yiddish lyrics that paraphrased Lincoln and Marx. The lively stench of fish flesh and felled tree and turned earth, the rumble of the dredgers and steam shovels grading mountains and filling in Sitka Sound, none of it seemed to touch him. He walked with his head down, a hunch in his shoulders, as if only burrowing through this world on his inexplicable way from one strange dimension to the next. Nothing penetrated or illuminated the dark tunnel of his passage. But when Isidore Lanzmann realized that the grinning man, hair slicked, shoes like a couple of Kaiser automobiles, smelling of the grilled onion cheeseburger he had just consumed at the lunch counter at Woolworth's, was his old friend Herr Chemitz from the Maccabee Youth Chess Club, he lifted his eyes. The eternal kink went out of his shoulder. He opened his mouth and closed it again, speechless with outrage, joy, and wonder. Then he burst into tears.
Hertz took Lanzmann's father back to Woolworth's, bought him lunch, an egg sandwich, his first milkshake, a decent pickle, and then led him down to Lincoln Street, to the new Hotel Einstein, in whose cafe the great exiles of Jewish chess met every day to demolish one another without pity or heart. Lanzmann's father, half-demented at this point by fat, sugar, and the lingering ill effects of typhus, mopped up the room.
He took on all comers and sent them out of the Einstein so soundly thrashed that one or two of them never forgave him. Even then he displayed the mournful, agonized style of play that helped ruin the game for Lanzmann as a child.
"Your father played chess," Herr Chemitz once said, "like a man with a toothache, a hemorrhoid and gas."
He sighed. He moaned. He tugged in fits at the patchy remnant of his brown hair or chased it with his fingers back and forth across his pate like a pastry chef scattering flour on a marble slab. The blunders of his opponents were each a separate cramp in the abdomen. His own moves, however daring, however startling and original and strong, struck him like successive pieces of terrible news, so that he covered his mouth and rolled his eyes at the sight of them. Uncle Hertz's style was nothing like that. He played calmly, with an air of unconcern, keeping his body at a slight angle to the board, as if expecting very shortly to be served a meal or to take a pretty girl onto his lap. But his eyes saw everything, the way they'd seen the telltale tremor in Tartakower's hand that day at the Maccabee Youth Chess Club. He took in his reversals without alarm and his chances with a faint air of amusement. Smoking Broadway's end on end, he watched his old friend squirm and mutter his way through the assembled geniuses of the Einstein. Then, when the room was laid to waste, Hertz made the necessary move.
He invited Isidore Lanzmann home.
In the summer of 1948, the Chemitz family lived in a two-room apartment in a brand-new building on a brand-new island. The building was home to 24 families, all of them polar bears, as the first-wave refugees called themselves. The mother slept in the bedroom, Fredel got the sofa, and Hertz made his bed on the floor. By now they were all staunch Alaskan Jews, which meant they were utopians, which meant they saw imperfection everywhere they looked. A barbed-tongued and quarrelsome family, in particular Fredel Chemitz, who at 14 already stood 5 feet 8 inches tall and weighed 110 kilograms.
She took one look at Lanzmann's father, hovering uncertainly in the doorway of the apartment, and correctly diagnosed him to be as unreclaimable and inaccessible as the wilderness that she had come to regard as her home.
It was love at first sight.
In later years, it was tough for Lanzmann to get much out of his father about what, if anything, he had seen in Fredel Chemitz.
She was not a bad-looking girl. Egyptian-eyed, olive-skinned, in her short pants, hiking boots, and the rolled sleeves of her Pendleton shirt, she exuded the old Maccabee movement spirit of mens sana in corpore sano.
She pitied Isidore Lanzmann deeply for the loss of his family,
for the suffering he had endured in the camps. But she was one of those polar bear kids who handled their own feelings of guilt at having escaped the filth, the starvation, the ditches and killing factories, by offering survivors a constant stream of advice, information, and criticism disguised as morale-boosting, as if the choking, low-hanging black pall of the destruction could be lifted by one determined kibitzer.
That first night, Lanzmann's father slept with Hertz on the floor of the Chemitz apartment.
The next day, Fredel took him shopping for clothes, paying for them out of her own bat mitzvah nest egg. She helped him rent a room from a recent widower who lived in the building.
She massaged his scalp with an onion, in the belief that this would cause his hair to renew itself. She fed him calf liver for his tired blood. For the next 5 years, she nudged and badgered and bullied him until he sat up straight, made eye contact when speaking, learned American, and wore dentures. She married him the day after she turned 18 and got a job at the Sitka Tag, working her way up through the women's page to features editor. She worked 60 to 75 hours a week, 5 days a week, until her death from cancer when Lantzman was in college. During that time, Hertz Shemitz impressed the American lawyers at Fein Harmaten so much that they took up a subscription and pulled the strings they needed to pull to send him to law school in Seattle. He later became the first Jew hired by the Sitka detail of the FBI, its first district director, and eventually, having caught Hoover's eye, ran the Bureau's regional counterintelligence program.
Lantzman's father played chess.
Every morning in rain, snow, or fog, he walked 2 miles to the Hotel Einstein coffee shop, sat down at an aluminum-topped table in the back, facing the door, and took out a small set of maple and cherry chessmen that had been a present from his brother-in-law. Every night he sat at his bench in the back of the little house on Adler Street, where Lantzman grew up, in Halibut Point, looking over the 8 or 9 correspondence games he had going at any one time. He wrote notes for Chess Review. He revised a biography of Tartakower that he never quite finished or abandoned. He drew a pension from the German government, and with the help of his brother-in-law, he taught his son to hate the game he himself loved.
"You don't want to do that," Lantzman's father would plead after Lantzman released, with bloodless fingers his knight or pawn, to meet the fate that always came as a surprise to Lantzman, no matter how much he studied, practiced, or played the game of chess.
"Take it from me."
"I do."
"You don't."
But in the service of his own small misery, Lantzman could be stubborn, too. Satisfied, burning with shame, he would watch unfold the grim destiny that he had been unable to foresee. And Lantzman's father would demolish him, flay him, vivisect him, gazing at his son all the time from behind the sagging porch of his face. After some years of this sport, Lantzman sat down in his mother's typewriter to write his father a letter in which he confessed his loathing for the game of chess and begged his father not to force him to play any more. Lantzman carried this letter in his satchel for a week, enduring 3 more bloody defeats, and then mailed it from the Unterstadt post office. 2 days later, Isidore Lantzman killed himself in room 21 of the Hotel Einstein by an overdose of Nembutal.
After that, Lantzman started to have some problems. He wet the bed, got fat, stopped talking. His mother put him in therapy with a remarkably gentle and ineffectual doctor named Melamed. It was not until 23 years after his father's death that Lantzman discovered the fatal letter, in a box that also held a fair copy of the unfinished biography of Tartakower. It turned out that Lantzman's father had never even opened a letter from his son, let alone read it. By the time the mailman delivered it, Lantzman's father was already dead.
6. Lantzman is tripping on the memory of those old chess-playing kids, hunched at the back of the Café Einstein, as he drives out to pick up Berko. It is 6:15 in the morning by his watch. By the sky, the empty boulevard and the stone of dread lying in his belly— it is the dead of night. Sunrise, this close to the Arctic Circle and the winter solstice, is still at least 2 hours off. Lantzman is at the wheel of a 1971 Chevrolet Chevelle Supersport, which he bought 10 years ago in an access of nostalgic optimism, and has driven until all its secret flaws seem indistinguishable from his own. In the 71 model year, the Chevelle went from 2 pairs of headlight bulbs to a single pair. Right now, one of these bulbs is blown. Lantzman gropes his way Cyclops-style along the promenade. Ahead of him rise the tower blocks of the Schwarzenjam on their artificial spit of land in the middle of Sitka Sound, huddled in the darkness like prisoners rounded up with a powerful hose. Russian Starkers developed the Schwarzenjam during the Middle 80s on purest quake-bait landfill in the first heady days of legalized casino gambling. Timeshares, vacation homes, and bachelor pads, that was the idea— with the Grand Yalta Casino and its jumping tables at the center of the action. But legal gambling is out now, banned by the Traditional Values Act, and the casino building houses a kosher mart, a Walgreens, and a big Macher outlet store. The Starkers went back to bankrolling illegal policy rackets, betting mills, and floating craps games. The swingers and vacationers gave way to a population of upper lowlifes, Russian immigrants,
a smattering of ultra-Orthodox Jews, and a bunch of bohemian semi-professionals who like the atmosphere of ruined festivity that lingers in the neighborhood like a strand of tinsel on the branch of a bare tree. The tight Shemitz family lives in the Dnieper on the 24th floor. The Dnieper is round as a stack of pie tins. Many of its residents, spurning fine views of Mount Edgecombe's collapsed cone, the gleaming safety pin, or the lights of the Unterstadt, have enclosed their curving balconies with storm windows and louvers in order to gain an extra room. The tight Shemitzes did that when the baby came along, the first baby. Now both little tight Shemitzes sleep out there, stashed away on the balcony like disused skis.
Lonsman parks the Supersport in the spot behind the dumpsters that he has come to view as his own, though he supposes a man should not come to cherish tender feelings toward a parking place. Simply having a place to put his car that is 24 stories down from a standing invitation to breakfast should never pass in a man's heart for a homecoming. He's a few minutes ahead of 6:30, and though he's pretty sure that everybody is awake in the tight Shemitz household, he decides to take the stairs. The Dnieper stairwell reeks of sea air, cabbage, cold cement. When he gets to the top, he lights a papyrus to reward himself for industry and stands on the tight Shemitz doormat, keeping the mezuzah company. He has one lung coughed up and the other on its way when Esther Malkatich opens the door. She holds a home pregnancy test stick with a bead on its business end of what must be urine. When she notices Lonsman noticing it, she coolly makes it disappear into a pocket of her bathrobe. "You know there's a doorbell, right?" she says through a tangled curtain of hair, brick-brown and too fine for the bob she always sports. It has a way of spilling across her face, especially when she is cracking wise. I mean, coughing works, too. She leaves the door open, and Lonsman, standing there on the thick choir mat that says, "Get lost." Lonsman touches two fingers to the mezuzah on his way in, and then gives them a perfunctory kiss. That is what you do if you are a believer like Berko, or a mocking asshole like Lonsman. He hangs his hat and overcoat on an elk antler rack by the front door. He follows Esther Malky's skinny ass, wrapped in a white cotton robe, down the hall and into the kitchen. The kitchen is narrow, laid out galley style, the stove, sink, and refrigerator down one side, cabinets down the other. At the end, a breakfast bar with two stools overlooks the living dining room. Steam curls out of a waffle iron on the counter in cartoon locomotive puffs. The drip-filter coffee maker hawks and spits like a decrepit Jewish policeman after 10 flights of steps. Lonsman sidles up to the stool he favors and stands beside it. From the hip pocket of his tweed blazer, he takes a pocket chess set and unwraps it. He bought it at the all-night drugstore on Korchik Platz. "Fat man still in his pajamas," he says. "Getting dressed." "Fat baby?"
"Picking the necktie."
"And the other one, what's his name?"
In fact, his name, thanks to a recent vogue for crafting given names from family names, is Feingold Tite Shemitz. They call him Goldie. 4 years ago, Lanceman had the honor to hold down Goldie's scrawny legs while an ancient Jew with a knife came after his foreskin. His Majesty. In answer, she nods her head toward the living dining.
"Still sick," Lanceman says.
"Better today."
Lanceman goes around the breakfast bar, past the glass-topped dining table, and over to the big white sectional sofa to get a look at what the television is doing to his godson.
"Look who it is," he says. Goldie is wearing his polar bear jammies, the height of retrospective chic for an Alaskan Jewish kid.
Polar bears, snowflakes, igloos, the northern imagery that was so ubiquitous when Lonsman was a boy, it's all back in style again.
Only this time it seems to be meant ironically. Snowflakes, yes, the Jews found them here, though thanks to greenhouse gases, there are measurably fewer than in the old days. But no polar bears, no igloos, no reindeer. Mostly just a lot of angry Indians, fog, and rain, and half a century of a sense of mistakenness so keen, worked so deep into the system of the Jews, that it emerges everywhere, even on their children's pajamas.
"You ready to work today, Goldie?" Lonsman says.
He lays the back of his hand against the boy's forehead. It feels nice and cool.
Goldie's schnappish the dog yarmulke hangs crooked, and Lonsman smooths it and adjusts the bobby pin that holds it in place.
"Ready to fight crime?"
"Sure thing, Uncle."
Lonsman reaches out to shake the boy's hand, and without even looking, Goldie slides his dry paw into Lonsman's.
A minute blue rectangle of light swims on the tear layer of the boy's dark brown eyes.
Lantzman has watched this program with his godson before, on the educational channel.
Like 90% of the television they watch, it comes from the South and is shown dubbed into Yiddish. It concerns the adventures of a pair of children with Jewish names who look like they might be part Indian and have no visible parents. They do have a crystalline magical dragon scale that they wish on in order to travel to a land of pastel dragons, each distinguished by its color and its particular brand of imbecility. Little by little, the children spend more and more time with their magical dragon scale until one day they travel off to the land of rainbow idiocy and never return. Their bodies are found by the night manager of their cheap flop, each with a bullet in the back of the head.
Maybe, Lantzman thinks, something gets lost in the translation. Still want to be a Nas when you grow up, Lantzman says. Like your dad and your Uncle Meyer?
Yes, Goldie says without enthusiasm.
You bet I do.
That's the boy. They shake hands again.
This conversation is the equivalent of Lantzman's kissing the mezuzah, the kind of thing that starts out as a joke and ends up as a strap to hang on to.
You taking up chess? Estemalka says when he walks back into the kitchen.
God forbid, says Lantzman.
He climbs up onto his stool and struggles with the tiny pawns and knights and kings of the travel set, setting them up to reflect the board left behind by the so-called Emmanuel Lasker. He has a hard time telling the pieces apart, but every time he holds one up to his face to get a good look at it, he drops it. Stop looking at me that way, he says to Esther Malky, just guessing. I don't like it.
Damn it, Meyer, she says, watching his hands.
You have the shakes.
I didn't sleep all night.
Uh-huh. The thing about Esther Malka Teich is that before she went back to school, became a social worker, and married Berko, she enjoyed a brief but distinguished career as a South Sitka fuck-up. She has a couple of small-bore criminals in her past, a regretted tattoo on her belly, and a bridge in her jaw, a souvenir of the last man to mistreat her. Lantzman has known her longer than Berko has, having busted her on a vandalism charge when she was still in high school. Esther Malka understands how to handle a loser, by intuition and habit, and without any of the reproach she brings to bear on her own wasted youth. She goes to the refrigerator and takes out a bottle of Brunner Adler, pops the top, and hands it to Lantzman. He rolls it against his sleepless temples, then takes a long swallow. So, he says, feeling better in an instant. You're late? She puts on a half-theatrical expression of guilt, goes to the pregnancy test stick, then leaves her hand in the pocket, clutching the stick without taking it out.
Lantzman knows, because she has broached the subject once or twice, that Esther Malka worries he might envy her and Berko their successful program of breeding and their two fine sons. Lantzman does, at times, with bitterness.
But when she brings it up, he generally bothers to deny it. Shit, he says as a bishop goes skittering across the floor and disappears under the bar counter.
Was it a black one or a white?
Black, bishop, shit, it's gone.
Esther Malka goes to the spice rack, tightens the waistband of her robe, studies her options. Here, she says. She takes out a jar of chocolate sprinkles, unscrews it, tips one into her palm, and hands it to Lantzman. Use that. Lantzman is kneeling on the ground under the counter. He finds the missing bishop and manages to poke it into its hole at H6. Esther Malka puts the jar back in the cabinet and returns her right hand to the mystery of her bathrobe pocket.
Lantzman eats the chocolate sprinkle. Berko knows, he says. Esther Malka shakes her head, hiding behind her hair.
It's nothing, she says.
Officially nothing?
She shrugs.
Didn't you look at the test?
I'm afraid to.
You're afraid to what? Says Berko, appearing at the door to the kitchen with young Pinkus Tight Shemitz, inevitably Pinky, tucked into the crook of his right arm. A month ago they made a party for the kid with a cake and a candle.
So, Lantzman reckons, that will bring in the third Tight Shemitz, if any, at around 21-22 months after the second, and 7 months after reversion. 7 months into the unknown world to come. Another diminutive prisoner of history and fate, another potential messiah, for messiah, say the experts, is born into every generation, to fill the sails of Elijah the Prophet's demented caravel of dreams. Esther Malka's hand emerges from her pocket without the pregnancy test, and she gives Lantzman a South Sitka high sign with one arched eyebrow.
Afraid to hear what I had to